Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Certain topics make people think differently about themselves and the world around them. Love and loss, aging and mortality, gender and culture, parents and children, aging, meaning and redemption, hope and change. This week's show focuses on a book that offers a deeply personal yet universal tour of our hearts and minds. Written by a best-selling author who is also a psychotherapist, this book will change the way you look at therapy and life as it provides a revealing portrait of what it means to be human, the story of our own mysterious lives and our power to transform them. Our guest today is Lori Gottlieb, author of the book Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed. Lori is a psychotherapist and New York Times bestselling author who also writes the Atlantic's weekly Dear Therapist advice column. A contributing editor at the Atlantic, she also writes regularly for the New York Times and has appeared on the Today Show, Good Morning America, CBS This Morning, CNN, and NPR. Her other books include Marry Him, The Case for Settling for Mr. Goodenough, and Inside the Cult of Kibu, and Other Tales of the Millennial Gold Rush. Hello, Lori, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Hey, this is an unusual book in that you go behind the scenes, or we go behind the scenes with you, and see not just you with four of your patients, but also you as a patient with your own therapist. And other therapist authors, like Irving Yalom, for instance, have kept their personal lives private, and this is what therapists generally do with their clients. What made you decide to include your own story?
I wanted to bring people inside the therapy room because I wanted them to see people's real lives and how we get through our struggles. And I follow in the book four main patients. There are other people woven throughout, but I'm the fifth patient, and I wanted to do that because I didn't want to be the expert up on high. I wanted to show my own humanity, and I think one of the things that we take away from the book is that we're more the same than we are different, and I really wanted to include myself in that.
Yeah, well, I think you did a really good job because usually, you know, as you put it in the book, there are two tropes of the therapist in our culture, the very removed person who goes, uh-huh, and it's a very blank slate, and on the other extreme, the hot mess. And it seemed like your challenge was to create a new trope, a human being, as you put it. So please explain what you mean by being a human being.
I mean that we all struggle. Nobody is immune to struggle. And I think that it's very hard to be somebody who doesn't experience that. So I just wanted to be a normal human being in the book. And at the same time, you also see me being a clinician and helping my patients. But I think the fact that I'm a normal human being is what helps me help people the most. I tell this story in the book about a colleague of mine who she and her husband were trying to have a baby, and they'd gone through a lot of heartbreak on that path. And she was finally pregnant, and she was standing in a Starbucks when she got a call from her doctor that the pregnancy wasn't viable. And she just broke down sobbing. And one of her patients happened to walk into the Starbucks and saw her and immediately walked out and never came back. He was so, I guess, freaked out, at the sight of his therapist sobbing like that. And of course, I don't want my therapist taking that call during my session. But if that were me and that was my therapist, I would trust that person all the more to understand me and my pain, because she's not a robot. She had a very normal human reaction to something that's painful.
Right. Well, we tend to idealize therapists, I think, especially if we're going to them. And your book does a great service in exemplifying what you just mentioned, because it begins, the book begins with a personal relationship crisis that you are having, and you don't seem to hold back. And do you think that this has helped you? Is this, but then again, in your therapy sessions, like you described with your four clients, you're not telling them personal details of your life. Did it feel risky for you to be so self-revealing in the book? Were you afraid of how you might come off?
Oh, absolutely. I think, the patients in the book are all of the details are changed, so they're anonymous. But I'm not. And so I think there's a tendency to want to, the first draft was very real and raw. And I think then when I realized that I was going to be sending it to my editor, I had this instinct of wanting to kind of, clean it up a little bit. But then I realized that's not the right thing to do. Because if my patients are being that vulnerable, I needed to be that vulnerable also.
Yeah. I thought it was really inspiring how real and genuine you come across as a human being. It really was made for a very interesting story, actually, of the interweaving of a bunch of stories of your four clients, of your own situation, and of your relationship with your therapist. Were you hoping that this book would change the way that people think about therapy?
I do. I really want to demystify what therapy is. I think a lot of people have outdated or just misinformed notions of what therapy is. And I wanted to make it clear that it's this very rich human connection. And I really feel that we grow in connection with others. And I think some people find or imagine that therapy is mysterious or weird or off-putting, but it's actually a very, I think, enriching experience. And I wanted people to see what that looks like. I think people imagine that therapy is this thing where you go and you talk about all your problems and that I just sit there and listen to problems all day. And that's not true. I think that so much goes on that's heroic in the therapy room. Like, people are taking risks or they're doing something they never thought possible. They're changing their lives in these significant ways. And even those little moments of heroics are so beautiful to watch. And I wanted people to really see the transformative power of this interaction and what people can get out of it.
Yeah, I think your work does a great job of revealing about the relationship between the patient and the therapist and how important that is and how that's really where the action is. Whereas a lot of people think of therapy as, getting advice or being told what to do by some kind of expert. And speaking of that,
yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I would say, speaking of that, you write a weekly Dear Therapist column for The Atlantic. I wonder how being an advice columnist is related to what you do as a therapist.
That's a great question, because in some ways they're very similar and in some ways they're different. My advice column is a little bit different from the traditional advice column, meaning that I tend to, instead of giving direct advice, I tend to tell people what a therapist might be thinking if they were presented with that situation, but maybe wouldn't say in a first session. And so I help people to think about the problem in a different way so that they can make a better choice about what they want to do about it. And hopefully I'm helping them to see some blind spots. I'm helping them to see the ways that they have a role in this or that they have choices in a situation where they feel like they don't. But I think that they're different in the sense that when somebody comes into the therapy room, I'm listening not just to their story, but I'm listening to their flexibility with the story. Because I know that it's told through a certain lens.
Right.
And usually that person is sort of gunning for me to take a position that matches theirs. And it's sort of like the way that I talk in the book about the difference between idiot compassion and wise compassion. And idiot compassion is what our friends do. It's kind of like we take our friend's side, like, my boss is a jerk. Oh yeah, your boss is a jerk. You know, we don't, even though you might have ended up with that in that situation 9 other times, maybe there's something going on with you. The wise compassion is what therapists do, is we hold up a mirror to help people see themselves more clearly and to help them see what they're doing, the patterns that they keep repeating that are not serving them. So I think in a letter, I have to really kind of help the person see another perspective, but I don't have enough information and I can't ask follow-up questions.
Right.
And in the therapy room, there's a lot of interaction and I can help edit the story as we go along.
Right. Well, you know, big difference is that you're going to actually have an ongoing relationship as a therapist that you're not going to have as an advice columnist. And as you point out in the book, study after study shows the most important factor in the success of treatment is the relationship between the therapist and the client, the experience of, quote, feeling felt. How does that really help?
I think ultimately we want to all be understood. And sometimes out in the world, we don't really listen to one another. We don't really hear the other person. We have our own agenda. And I think that in the therapy room, our only agenda as therapists is to help you to relate better to yourself and other people. And so I think that people feel very felt. I think they feel very understood by someone who's really listening to them in a deep way.
Right. You write, quote, in therapy, we aim for self-compassion. Am I human? Versus self-esteem, which is a judgment. Am I good or bad? Self-compassion.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what you're talking about. Helping some people develop that.
That's true. I think that we can be so unkind to ourselves. And self-compassion isn't self-esteem. Self-compassion is that you take responsibility for what you want to change and the things that you're doing that you need to take responsible for. But you also do it in a compassionate way. You don't self-flagellate. You use it as a tool, as a learning experience, so that you can do something differently the next time. And if you listen to the way we speak to ourselves, the voices in our heads, we're so cruel to ourselves. And we speak to ourselves in a way that we would never speak to people we cared about, our partners, our friends, our children. We just don't do that.
Do you find that people automatically or very quickly acclimate to the safe space of the therapy room where they can feel understood and not judged?
I think it depends on the person. I think that it depends what their attachments are like outside and how well they attach to people. But I think that we do our best to help people to feel safe in the room. Most people like coming to therapy, you know, when they have a good relationship with their therapist, that they feel like it's a place that they can talk about things that they have trouble talking about out in the world.
Right. Well, I mean, especially if they're going to a gifted therapist, as you appear to be, because there they can expect not to be judged and to experience some empathy for what they're feeling and maybe some encouragement for self-compassion. You know, I love the way that you interweave some philosophy as well as psychological expertise throughout the book. For instance, this is pretty funny. You say, it's proposed that happiness be classified as a psychiatric disorder and be included future editions of the major diagnostic manuals under the new name, Major Affective Disorder, Pleasant Type. Could you expound on that?
So that's a quote from a psychological journal that I found interesting, because I think so many people are chasing happiness, and happiness as a byproduct of something else, like fulfillment or meaning, is great, but happiness as an end goal in itself is kind of doomed to failure. And so, you know, I think what we do in the therapy room is we're helping people to find purpose and meaning and connection. And those are the things that will lead to happiness. But we're not there so that, you know, we can make them happy.
So you don't think happiness is really a very valid psychological goal for people?
I just don't think it's a realistic goal. Happiness is fleeting like any other emotion, right? So joy is fleeting, sadness is fleeting, anxiety is fleeting. You know, feelings, I like to say, are like the weather. They blow in and out. So I think that you need to be grounded and have purpose when you wake up every day. What is it that you're excited about? What is it that gives you meaning? How is your life peopled? What are your connections? Those are the things that are important in our inner peace.
Yeah, and you talk about connections, and we can talk about relationships, and that's what your book is all about. I saw your book as a relationship book, and I'm not talking about the personal drama that you shared about breaking up with your boyfriend at the beginning of the book, who basically had a very disingenuous reason for wanting to break up with you. But I thought that it was pretty cool the way that you expounded on some therapeutic concepts, like, for instance, maladaptive attachment styles and how these can be modified in adulthood. In fact, this, you say, is a lot of the work of therapy. So what do you mean by that?
That people learn how to relate in childhood through modeling, through their own experiences in their families. And sometimes what happens is if they didn't get good modeling, they carry those patterns into adulthood without realizing it. So they'll choose partners that are very similar, even though they look different on the outside, from the people that they were raised by. They'll keep getting into the same situation over and over where they're disappointed or someone isn't an appropriate partner for them. So we try to help people understand their patterns so that they can change them.
Now, one of the themes of the book is that our stories form the core of our lives and give them deeper meaning. So can we rewrite our stories? I mean, aren't our stories kind of stuck in the past?
I don't think so at all. I think that a lot of my job, I have a writing background, and I think that a lot of my job as a therapist is almost to be an editor for people's stories. So when people come in with a story, they have maybe a faulty narrative, like I'm unlovable, or nothing will ever work out for me, or I'm better than everyone else, you know, whatever their narrative is. And we, you know, that served them. It was protection for them growing up, but it doesn't, or it was something that they internalized growing up, but that story is outdated. They've outgrown that story, but they don't realize it. And then there are other stories that are just faulty. Like, you know, sometimes they have the major characters and the minor characters in the story mixed up, or who is the protagonist and who is the antagonist, or is the protagonist going in circles, or is the protagonist moving forward? And so we use the past to understand why they're doing what they're doing in the present, but then we need to rewrite the next chapter. And so I always say that insight is the booby prize of therapy, that you can have all the insight in the world, but if you don't make changes out in the world, the insight is useless. So we're really working with, here's what you're doing. We want to shine a light on that, but also here's how you can change it. And you actually have to make changes in your behavior out in the world, or else there's no point in coming to see us every week.
Right. Well, that can be easier said than done. Do you perceive, as I do, that we live in particularly anxiety-ridden and depressive times, or is that just me?
I think we live in a very stressful time. And I also think we live in a time where partly we're getting bad news all day long because of the 24-hour news cycle, and it's very stressful. I think that our lives are more stressful, that the pace of our lives is faster. We don't have organic connections with people in the same way that we did before. So we end up, you know, not being face to face with other people. And we, you know, we lose out on those organic connections. And I think to our detriment, even, you know, couples will say at night we're co-computing, you know, we're not really connecting. We don't, you know, we're not places where there's nothing pinging or dinging or there aren't screens or phones on the table or screens in the restaurant. And I think that that really has an effect on our mental health.
You know, you talk about changing behaviors and how really that's the goal, not just having insights. What about personality disorders? I thought it was interesting how you described them. Do you think they're more prevalent now? I mean, I saw a statistic 10 years ago that 15% of the population have a personality disorder, but it seems like I'm running into people all the time that sort of tick off the boxes for various personality disorders, you know, like narcissistic personality disorder, like, you know, what our president seems to have. Are they more prevalent now, do you think?
I don't know if they're more prevalent. I know that I think diagnosis is tricky because when I see people who have maybe traits of a personality disorder, I don't want to label them. I use it in the back of my head because I have training, and so I know what might help with that particular style of relating. But I also don't want to lose the person behind the diagnosis and just see them as a personality disorder. So I really want to get to know the person because they're much more than that set of behaviors.
Uh-huh. Do you think there's any value in some of the current trends that we see, particularly here on the West Coast, of people using psychedelic drugs for therapeutic purposes, like, for instance, psilocybin or ayahuasca? Do you know anything about that?
I don't.
Okay. Now, everyone in the book changes a lot from the beginning to the end, but you write about how, about why we resist change, even when it's good for us. What makes it so hard? And how much change can we realistically expect from therapy?
So, you know, I think that even positive change is hard because with change comes loss. And I think that we cling to the familiar, even if the familiar is unpleasant or even downright miserable, that at least we know what it is. So, and I think when we go into something new, we end up, you know, it's the uncertainty of the unknown. And I think that makes us very anxious.
Right.
Hey, so I've really enjoyed our conversation, but I do have to go. And it was so nice to talk to you, Paul. And I'm so glad we got to chat today.
Me too, Lori. Thank you. There's so much more we could explore, but we've obviously run out of time.
And okay. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
All the best.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And I want to make sure to tell our listeners about Lori's website, which is lorigottlieb.com. And for those who tuned into Pathways late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast. Today, we've been visiting with Lori Gottlieb, author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed via KBOO.fm Sunday mornings at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes and other free podcast servers. I want to thank you for tuning into the show today. She's a fascinating guest, and I wish we hadn't been interrupted by technical problems that we had to start out with. And obviously, she's got a very busy schedule, as her interruption revealed. But her book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, is a great read and definitely well worth checking out. And I encourage all of our listeners to do so. Well, this is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And I want to say thanks again to Lori Gottlieb and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.